You're now in the huddle with Coach Calls Timeout, the podcast that dissects the mind of a different basketball coach every episode. We uncover what makes them successful and how their story translates to your coaching journey. Let's unlock your team's potential together. We are back. Welcome to season two of the podcast. We're going to start off with the same game plan as always and see how things go. Interview successful basketball coaches and find out what makes them tick. We're starting off with a bang, two coaches for the price of one, two Canada basketball head coaches, Roy Rana and Carly Clark. This summer, Roy coached the Canadian under-19 men's team at the FIBA World Cup in Egypt. With Roy at the helm, Canada won its first ever gold medal in international play. He's also been recently named the head coach of the Canadian men's program. Carly Clark was making history this summer as well. She was the head coach of the Canadian under-19 women's team at the FIBA World Cup in Italy. Carly led the team to a bronze medal, its best finish ever at that level. Both coaches are also the head coaches of the men's and the women's basketball programs at Ryerson University in Toronto. As usual, Brian's going to handle the interview, but first a couple of quick things. Near the beginning, Brian accidentally says it was a national tournament when he's talking to Carly, but it was obviously an international tournament. Second, stick around after the interview for a discussion with myself and Brian on one of the questions from the forum that we have on Coach Calls Timeout. It's a good tip for coaches on how to deal with parents. All right, welcome to Coach Calls Timeout. This is episode 29. Brian Jonker here. It is actually our first episode of season two. Today, we're very fortunate to have back with us two people who joined us last year, Carly Clark and Roy Rana, who are the head coaches of the men's and women's team at Ryerson University, and that's where I was fortunate enough to be allowed to come today and sit down with the two of them. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. For those listening, I buried the lead in there, maybe somewhat intentionally, but the episodes we did last year, and I'd encourage any coach to go back and listen to them, we talked about your coaching journeys and how you got to where you were. Today, though, I really want to celebrate and discuss the success that you guys have had with our national programs. Both of you were the head coaches this summer of teams, the under-19 teams, and had accomplished things that had never been done in this country. So in Carly's case, your team won a bronze medal at the national championships. Fantastic. First medal, under-19 women. Roy, in your case, you did something that hadn't been done across any Canadian men's national team at any level, and that's win a championship. And you won a gold medal in Egypt. Carly was in Italy, I believe. And so today we wanted to discuss a little bit about those accomplishments and the kids and what goes into some of that sort of stuff. Before we do that, or leading into that, Carly, how did you get involved in the national team or in the national program?
It started probably 8 or 9 years ago. I started coaching center four performance, in Nova Scotia when I was just getting into coaching in 2008, probably. From there, I had an opportunity to go work with the NIDA program that existed in Hamilton and was an apprentice coach for a year there. And that opportunity led me to get into head coaching at the university level. And from there, I just applied for our U16 national team the summer after that and was selected as the head coach, and since then have spent every summer working with different age groups and most recently the U19 team.
And Roy, how did you get to where you are with Canada basketball?
A little bit of a longer journey for me. I actually started with Basketball Ontario. I was doing MDP and JDP back in the day when those programs were prominent, and so that was probably late 90s that I started that. And after back-to-back national championships in a Canada Summer Games where we won gold, got asked to kind of help out with the junior national team as an assistant. Spent a summer there, and then when FIBA started the cadet age group, Canada Basketball made a decision to have their CP coaches be the ones who led that program, and I was running the CP program in Ontario at that point in time and ended up getting that job, and the rest is history. We had great success. We qualified the first year. Then we won a bronze medal with Pangles and Wiggins and those guys the following year in Hamburg, and it just kind of rolled from there.
So when you get put in these positions, Carly, do you select your assistants, or what's the process for putting your staff together?
Canada Basketball really takes the lead on that. They're the ones that are developing coaches, at least on the women's side, and developing a pool of coaches to work with. They're great in giving me some input, and you know, we have conversations around what the staff could look like, but ultimately they make the final decisions on the women's side.
And then when you get together with your staff, philosophically, is there a way that people would prefer you to play as well, or is that strictly up to you?
There's definitely, you know, a Canadian style of play that on the women's side that's become a point of emphasis. And I've got, I would say, the freedom to work within that and just trying to implement some key concepts and principles. And but ultimately, we build around the team that we expect to have, and we get to see our athletes. On the women's side, we'll have a camp in December, a camp in March, and then a camp as we lead into our competition in the summer. So we get a sense of what our team could look like and build the plan offensively and defensively around that.
And Roy, is that similar on the men's side? Do the men's and women's programs discuss together anything, or are you kind of run independent of each other?
It's probably a little bit of a combination. You know, Carly and I will discuss things and share. Fortunately, our offices are right beside each other, so it's easy for us to. You know, we're not full-time employees of Canada Basketball, so from an office perspective, I'm sure those conversations are being had as well. Process is fairly similar. I think, in my time, it's been a real collaboration as far as coaches are concerned, but obviously organizationally driven. Those final decisions are made at that level, but we do have some input on the names that were provided just to try and create the best possible team and complement. You know, from a technical perspective, much of that is driven down from the senior team level. And, you know, Jay Triano's been instrumental in that. Rome Barrett and Richard Garadini, that senior leadership team has driven down a lot of our processes. I think our alignment has become far better than it has maybe at any point in time since I've been involved, almost a decade now. So I think we're really starting to understand and establish a style of play, which is, I think, now starting to be, you know, show results. I mean, both on the men's and women's side, you know, I think we've been meddling pretty consistently now in FIBA Americas. And obviously now that's starting to transfer itself on a global level, which is pretty exciting.
So you talked about not being full-time employees. You are full-time employees at Ryerson. How does having a second team like that impact your full-time position here? And obviously, there's immense benefits to Ryerson having you guys in the positions that you're at the national level, whether it be from exposure to recruiting to all of that. But what's the support like from here at Ryerson in being involved in those programs? And secondarily, what's the time commitment away from your teams here at Ryerson? Roy, you want to start?
Sure. I mean, yeah, it's becoming more and more of a beast for me to tackle now that I'm also taking on our senior team during these qualification windows. But, I mean, there's certainly no way we could ever do it without the support of our university and our athletic department and our athletic director. I mean, Joseph's been instrumental in our rise here at Ryerson, but also in my own personal rise at Canada Basketball, because he's been able to give me the green light to go and pursue this passion internationally as well. So there's just no way we would be able to do it. And you know, as the challenges become greater, I think the support has matched it. You know, I have a great staff. I have a full-time assistant now in Borko Popovic, who's taking on a pretty heavy load. And I think everybody is committed to trying to, you know, see Canada do well and also see Ryerson do well. And I'd say probably even bigger than that now is my athletes understand that. Our players understand that. So it's a huge sacrifice. It's as much as it is, you know, there's that the profile build and the recruiting, you know, perceived recruiting advantages. There's a huge sacrifice that our players make, that our university makes, that, you know, our coaches make, because it's a ton of time. You know, we don't have an off season. We have two full-time jobs. I mean, coaching a national team is not a part-time job, although it may be treated that way. So, you know, just certainly couldn't get it done without the support that we have.
How do you manage your time, Carly?
Do you
have any examples of a day-to-day thing where you're trying to balance Ryerson versus what you're doing with the national stuff?
Well, I'd start by echoing Roy's comments and the administrative support we have in the department and from the university to just provide us with the opportunity to do it and the support. I also have a full-time assistant who takes on a great load, and the extended staff, and then our department helps tremendously in keeping our athletes on track when we're away. I would say, you know, my situation a little bit different than Roy's current situation in that the national team responsibilities or the bulk of it does not coincide directly with our Ryerson season. So to Roy's point, there is no off season because we tend to end the university season and then begin to plan pretty heavily for the national team season. So there's not always, for me, a lot of overlap in either season, but there's certainly always things going on in the background on both sides. So whether it's a planning call, getting out to watch some national team athletes at the same time that you're recruiting, those are things that might be done simultaneously. But there's not a ton of overlap in the bulk of the work. Or, you know, I find that I try and keep my mind focused on Ryerson in season and then national team in season. And to Roy's point, we've got the great support that keep things flowing on both sides when I'm not present with either of them.
And Roy, you touched on real briefly there the fact that you're also handling our senior men's national team through qualifying for the World Cup, I believe. That stuff is in the middle of your season. But not only that, what I'm curious about, I think the initial games are the end of November, maybe, your first qualifying games. Where do the players come from that? Because you're not going to get your NBA guys. You got to have other professional people in Europe that probably wouldn't release players.
Well, the only, you know, by rule, the only players that will not be released will be from the NBA and from the EuroLeague. All other players will be eligible. Now there'll be, you know, individual challenges, you know, and hopefully there won't be too many significant ones because the FIBA windows will close competitions during those time frames, like much like they do with soccer. So, you know, hopefully we'll have players from, you know, all around the world. And but we understand also that there's different challenges. You know, some may not be with, you know, maybe without a contract. Some may be dealing with injuries. Some, you know, it's a first for everyone all around the world going through this format. So I think there's going to be tremendous learning. But it's at the same time, there's no time to learn. Like you got to win games. You got to try to qualify. So it's a huge undertaking, and, you know, obviously I'm not taking it on myself. The organization of Canada Basketball understands it, and we're kind of attacking it on a daily basis.
It's got to be, I mean, you're not necessarily going to send the best teams to the World Cup if the best players aren't involved in the qualifying, I would think. So from an outsider looking in, that's the first thing that I noticed. But
it's really, can you build the best team you can with what you have in a week? And try to go win a game. And that's kind of what the deal is. And it's no different than sometimes what we do in a FIBA Americas when we have a short qualifying window and we take young kids and try to do the same thing. So it's not like it hasn't been done. It just hasn't been done this way at the senior team level on the men's side. And it's going to be an interesting challenge.
So when you're talking about selection of players for your teams, I'm imagining the pool of those players are selected by the full-time employees of Basketball Canada. They bring you a pool of players and then you have your tryouts for you and your coaching staff to select the final product.
That's generally how it works. I mentioned earlier, we've got usually at the age group level, three camps throughout a year on the women's side. So in December and March, we're evaluating athletes. We're following them throughout their seasons. And by we, I mean the organization. We've got a pool of people who are in charge of our talent ID and selection. So that doesn't fall solely on me, even when we get into the summer selection period. Certainly as a head coach and our coaching staff have great input in the final selection, but we've got support there still from the organization based on long-term planning, you know, senior team potential, and all the other factors that go into building a team. And I think that's important because as a coach with dual roles, who coaches national team and then coaches in a university setting, having the, you know, the talent ID people and the support in selection ensures there's a lack of bias and understanding about the national team principles.
And do you find that your attendance rate, if you will, the amount of people that are asked if they'd like to participate is very high on the women's side? Like, I think there's been challenges, especially at the higher levels on the men's side, when you get into contracts and injuries and this and that, where guys are not as, you know, willing to play for their country as they used to be, if we can say that. On the women's side, do you experience the same thing, or do you have pretty good
interest? I think generally speaking, we're getting all of the athletes that we're aware of, or majority of the athletes that we are aware of. I think Canada Basketball, the provincial organizations have all done a great job of instilling a sense of pride and passion, and young athletes have a goal of wanting to represent their country. And that's as big as a goal to get an NCAA scholarship or a U Sports scholarship or go play in the WNBA. Playing for the national team and representing Canada on the world stage is as important or more important for a lot of our young women.
And on the men's side, yeah, Roy?
I would say that, you know, first of all, I don't think that, I think it's a misnomer, and maybe to some degree, you know, a lack of understanding from a fan perspective. There may be one or two examples of athletes that are not willing to play on the senior men's national team. The bulk of our players, whether they're in the NBA or whether they're in Europe, they want to play. They're very passionate about representing their country. But each of them have individual situations that, for the most part, especially at the professional level, that sometimes they just can't play. They're just not in a place where they're, you know, capable due to contract situations. And sometimes, rightly so, it's a, you know, if the competition is one where they can take a break from their bodies after 80 games in a year, and that's not just in the NBA, it's a legitimate choice that sometimes athletes have to make. So we understand that. You know, at the youth level, things are changing so dramatically because there are the opportunities and options of things that can, that are out there. It's a unique challenge, but for the most part, throughout my career, I would say that most of our athletes are lining up and are very passionate about playing for Canada. You know, you asked about the talent ID thing, you know, from a Canada Basketball perspective on the men's side. There's been a tremendous growth on that side. I mean, there's staff and gyms all across the U.S. and not only in Canada watching prospects. You know, Maurizio Gherardini's out in Europe and staying connected to the players that are playing in Europe. There's been a lot of a real concentrated effort on behalf of the organization to get a real feel of our talent. And, you know, for me, when it comes to selecting a team, in the end, you know, I try to have as great an understanding and a feel for who those athletes are. I'll try to make sure that my voice is heard as far as, you know, the talent that we want in our depth charts and kind of in our training camps. And then they've been great, really. In the end, they've allowed myself and the coaching staff to select a team, pick the team, and build a team. We will have conversations about developmental players and whether they're ready or whether they're not. You know, we had a choice last year. We took two cadet age kids to FIBA Americas in Grant Shepherd and Jaden Bediako when they probably weren't ready. And this year at the World Championships, Grant Shepherd was a huge reason why we won. So it paid off 12 months down the road. And sometimes people don't understand those decisions, but that's our job to really kind of try and figure it out and look forward. So there's a lot there. And I think we're really putting a lot of energy in it as well.
So when you get to that stage where your teams are picked, this window that we talked about in the summer was probably 4 to 6 weeks max from the time you actually got together with your teams to select them and the championship games or bronze medal games that you were involved in. Take me, if you can, quickly through the process of being back here in Ontario with your teams after they're selected. Do you practice twice a day, Carly? Do they eat together? Do they sleep in the same place? Do the coaches all stay together? I mean, how close are you over that 1 month period?
We're very close. Our training camps are almost always at a university residence or college residence. This year we were at Humber College. So we're selected, we're eating, we're sleeping, we're training together pretty much 24 hours a day. So it's very intensive, and that's, I believe, critical in being able to build a team that's committed to the same things in a short amount of time. You know, certainly we try and build in some downtime and recovery time. Uh-huh. One of the biggest adjustments we've made over the last couple of years, which I think has actually really paid off, is we've been very cautious of our volume. So traditionally we would practice twice a day for 3 hours and be worried about making sure we get all of our systems and all of our plays and everything in. But we're very cautious with the load that we're putting on our athletes and finding other ways to build those things, so that we're leaving the country and traveling to our championships healthy and rested and fresh and ready to go. And we've come a long way in with our planning and the camps, as I mentioned before, leading into the summer, which allows us to be a little bit further ahead and allows us to do a little bit more off court and not have to spend 6 hours a day on the court.
Roy, do you, in these training camp situations, how often do you guys meet as a coaching staff to go over the things that you want to do next? Are things delegated where people might be preparing for other things that haven't even happened or are weeks away? How much time do the coaches all spend together?
So, you know, I think this is what most people think, that you start when a training camp starts, and it starts far before training camp begins. For our athletes, it's training camp. For our coaches, it's probably, you know, 2 to 3 months prior to stepping on the court, maybe even longer depending on time and opportunity. But it could be meetings, it could be conference calls, it could be watching film, it could be talking about players, it could be, you know, operations. I mean, there's a huge planning element that you have to have taken care of before you step on the floor, because when you step on the floor, it has to be just automatic. Like, there can't be any glitches. There can't be any mistakes as far as the, you know, I thought our practice was going to happen at this time and our meals an hour late. Like, if you do it the right way, then it has to operate, you know, it has to function without any glitches. And obviously there's always something that pops up, but you also have to be flexible enough to adapt to that. So there's a tremendous amount leading in. And then basically when you're in training camp, I mean, the coaches are meeting and before practice, after practice, in the evening, And just to touch upon, you know, what Carly said, I mean, I don't think what people understand is that when you're with somebody for 6 weeks straight, every day in an intensive situation where there's intensity and emotion and passion, that's a real challenge. Those are huge sacrifices that athletes have to make, coaches have to make. At times, everybody just needs a break from each other. And, you know, we were in Cairo, we couldn't leave the hotel because of security issues. So, you know, we're in a hotel, locked in a hotel for basically 12, 14 days. And, you know, how does that play itself out as far as group dynamics are concerned? But it's a tremendous opportunity, but I don't think people realize how hard it is and how demanding it is on athletes and coaches.
Your coaching staff is all over the place. I mean, you're New Mexico, you're Virginia Tech. So you'd have conference calls with the group. Do you delegate some tasks and say, hey, look after this for a while, or why don't you work on that and we'll get back in a couple of weeks and talk about it?
I mean,
or
there's some of that, and some of it is individual conversations. You know, fortunately for me, this year was a little different because I had some turnover in my staff, but for the most part, you know, I've had consistency, and so you kind of just know what it is. But it's sometimes it's not even sometimes it's a year before. Hey, like, you know, you've been, you know, taking a look at you know, pressure schemes, just keep looking at it, come to camp prepared with X, Y, and Z. It could be something as technical as that, or as it could be just a conversation about a particular player that a coach has a relationship with, and how can we best ensure that this young man or young woman is going to be successful in their experience.
So when you've got your team together, there's a number of these kids, I'm sure, that have spent time playing together through the years, but I'm sure there's also each year there's pieces that come and go and they get changed. As we all know as coaches, sometimes changing one piece makes a huge difference in the dynamic of the group. How do you, Carly, in a small, short period of time like this, do you have any examples for coaches out there of maybe a team building exercise or something you try to focus on to kind of try and get the group at least together early on in this process?
Yeah, well, like you said, our athletes are pretty familiar with each other because they had, at least this summer, played with each other at least some point in their career. But with that, bringing 12 people together is always a challenge. And this summer in particular, we really emphasize having our staff included in that, not just player-to-player to connections, but player-to-coach connections. And that was really our point of emphasis. I don't know that I have a one specific example, but we talked about connection on the floor and off the floor every single day. So whether it was just a question of the day, you've got to find someone different to chat about the answer to that question and get to know each other at a deeper level. We really emphasize that you know, to Roy's point, we are with each other through like thick and thin for a month straight or longer, that environment has to be like family. And for us, when we talked about it being like family, that means that you can laugh, you can cry, you can get mad, and then you get over it. And so we tried to build some deep connections really early on so that we could have the honest conversations, things would be dealt with, not linger. And with us, that was really successful and everyone was bought into the same goal.
Do you allow them to choose their roommates? Do you choose their roommates when they're staying together? Do you rotate them? Do you almost force that interaction with different people? How do you handle that?
Yeah, we don't let them choose. We certainly try and assign it and make sure they're connecting with different people. You know, there's traditionally on our teams four or five kids from Ontario that all know each other. So we'll try and mix them up with different people. And, you know, sometimes it might be positional. Sometimes it might be a younger player with an older, you know, leader. And we changed ours throughout the course of the month, just to continue to build those connections as we move to different locations.
Right. I think one of, the biggest challenges for coaches at any level with any team that they have over whatever time period they have is to establish roles. And I had read that you had thought one of the biggest reasons for the added success that you had this year was the ability for your group or the willingness to accept their roles. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about how in a short period of time, the challenge of a coach to establish roles with players and how you feel you go about doing that? Is it something, yeah, first of all, where the coaches are establishing as a group, hey, we believe this person should be this and could be that, and we need them to do this. And then it's up to you to go and decipher and find a way to get that person to buy in?
I think you just answered the question. Okay. Yeah, I think it's very intentional. I think it's very intentional. And I think it speaks to a little bit of what Carl was just talking about too, as far as, you know, building connectedness. I mean, the biggest thing is having conversations. If you're not speaking to your athletes on a regular and a consistent basis, how do you clarify what a role is? And two, how do you build trust in that relationship and the fact that if they accept that role, that, you know, one, it'll benefit the team, but also it'll benefit them. I mean, there is a natural desire for, you know, for self reward as well. And that's a good thing. But you got to try and find a way to mirror both. And for some players, it may be as simple as, hey, like, you're just going to be part of the team and you may not play a minute. And your role is going to have to be the best 12th man and wave the towel at the end of the bench. And, you know, you might be the star. And here's all the responsibilities that come with being the guy that's going to be viewed as the driver of performance, and having those honest conversations right up front when you select a team, and then really clarifying the roles when they come together. I think it's really just about having honest conversations with your players and finding out whether the roles that may take more sacrifice, whether they're willing to accept that. But I think if you have that up front, then you got a chance. If you don't address it right from the beginning, then it could become problematic as you go through this month long kind of intense, crazy experience, which is world championship summers are much, much longer than qualifiers. They're a different animal in themselves.
And Carly, the challenge at your level, what you're dealing with, is that almost in all cases, the players that you're bringing in are used to very large roles in the teams they're coming from. The stars, if you will. So now you get somebody who's a star on their university team, and now they're coming here and asked to be a role player. How difficult is that to communicate that and to have people buy into those things?
We talk about from day one in our opening meeting as a culture piece and in that exact thing, in that they're all coming from stars or being stars in their own individual teams, and automatically things are different and things are harder. But I would just, you know, echo Roy's comments almost exactly in that open, honest conversations right from the beginning. You know, everyone has to understand that their role is going to be different. You know, sometimes players will often come from a context to a national team where they're used to having the ball in the hands all the time. And their solution when a play is breaking down, as an example, is, well, just give me the ball and I'll go create a shot. At the world level, that that's not the solution. So even if it's a player that's out there and is, you know, having a really important role in the success on the floor, what that looks like for them is still very different, right? And then there's the players that aren't going to play a minute, and you've got to create the environment for that. But ultimately, it comes down to, I think, vision and goal setting. And if all the athletes are truly bought into trying to achieve what they say they want to achieve, then they're going to be willing to accept it if you have the right conversations. I know this summer we had four athletes that didn't play in four games at the World Championships, and you would not have known for a second that they did not play. And I truly believe that that was a reason why we were so successful, because their body language did not change once. And that is a really rare thing at any level.
And I just add to that, because I think the other thing too is that in a World Championship, you know, you're looking at between 7 and 9 games over a course of 10 to 12 days, and it's a season in 10 days, let's say. And just much like it would be a season in 6 months, you know, the person that starts at the beginning of the season may not start at the end of the season, and roles change. And even though we may have a conversation with a kid about, you know, the fact that they are the 12th man, by the end of the tournament, they could be, you know, first off the bench. They could be starting. There's a lot of different things that play itself out over the course of the summer. So, you know, I think it's not just about having those honest conversations, but also giving them a real picture of what a competition looks like and how to be prepared, because their role could change very quickly.
And at Coach Calls Timeout, the running theme with a lot of the people that we've talked to and our philosophies as well is that, as we've mentioned here today, you have to be able to adapt, and you have to be able to look in the mirror and say, we need to change some stuff. And in the windows you're talking about, they need to change quickly in some cases. Mm-hmm. So I think it all comes back to what you're talking about, and that's that constant communication with the individuals on a regular basis. And it doesn't get much more important than that. You're now over at your championships, let's say, and in your case, Roy, you're talking about being locked down because of security reasons. Does that mean that there's no time for sightseeing, there's no time for experiencing the culture, or
we got to the pyramids as a group. We got to the pyramids. We didn't get a lot of other things. We had a couple of drives to the city, which were an adventure in themselves in Cairo. But the reality is, one, I mean, we're not there to sightsee anyway. I mean, you want to add, because they're young kids, you want to give them an opportunity to kind of grow in other areas of their life. But we're there for World Championships. It's serious. We take it seriously. So, I mean, even if we weren't, you know, even if there was no security, I wouldn't even say concerns, but even if there wasn't just this whole security blanket around the tournament in Cairo, I'm not sure we'd be doing a lot of sightseeing anyway. And the kids understand that first of all, you know, being prepared and taking care of their bodies and all that stuff is the most important piece. But, everywhere we go, we try to at least give them a little bit of an experience of the local culture and the place that we're at, the history, whatever it is. Cairo's pretty spectacular. So it was a great opportunity for them to go to a place they may never go again in their lives. But those are small tastes that they're not, like, we're not on a foreign tour going to hang out.
But at the same time, Carly, you must have some athletes who've traveled, had limited travel in their life. They'd have some because they've probably come up through the program a little bit, but there must be some kids, regardless of whether you're going to see all of Italy, that are excited to get on the plane and go somewhere else to play.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, we typically will train for 10 to 12 days in Canada before we fly somewhere. And, the excitement at the first training or tryout is really high. And then by day 12, they're a little bit worn out again, and the motivation might wane a little bit. So when we get on the plane and, even if we're going to train for a couple of days before we play, it's like a fresh start a little bit. This summer we had similar opportunities. I mean, we weren't in Cairo, where there's some pretty magnificent history, but we spent a few days in France and then bused from France to Italy through the Alps and spent a day in Lake Como in Italy. So, we try and build a little bit in, like Roy said, to the experience, because it's, a pretty special thing to get to see the world playing a game. And for us, that was the perfect recharge, and it's a good change of scenery and just clearing of the mind, I think, because when you do have 9 games in 12 days or whatever it is, it's easy to be all in. And I think that's what one thing that allows us to constantly converse about roles and going back to that conversation is you wake up and you go have breakfast as a team, you have an opportunity to connect with someone. And in the university environment, it's harder because they're dealing with 4 or 5 other things that they're trying to manage at the same time. So it all really melds together in helping to aid the performance and the growth of the team.
And I just want to add something about our experience at Cairo that was interesting. For us, it worked out phenomenally well because our trip to the pyramids was the day after we lost to Spain. So, you know, here we are, we're devastated that we lost to Spain in our pool play, and everybody's expecting that we're going to finish first in our pool, and all of a sudden now it puts us on the side with the U.S., and nightmare scenario, and, you know, we're feeling pretty down about that loss, and the next day we're at the pyramids, and I think it was just kind of put everything back into perspective. It was a unique opportunity for us to do so. Sometimes it can be a real positive because it can shift the, you know, shift the mindset. So for us, maybe that was part of it. I don't know.
And Carly, I saw a bunch of pictures that were posted as you guys were over there. It seemed like you had a lot of family over there too, kids' families, like a lot of parents and stuff traveled. And how big a contingent was it? And did it help to have family like that there and a crowd, if you will?
Yeah, it was spectacular. I think 2/3 of our athletes at least had some family member there. And obviously, if you watch the webcast, you could see they were all in. I was fortunate that my mom was able to make the trip too, and that was her first experience. She said she would never do a world championship again because she was so anxious throughout it. But it was really special having all the families there. We had an opportunity to go out for a team dinner and include them in it, and that was the day before our quarterfinal game. And I think, you know, a little bit different than Roy's situation, but that was just a great energizer for the girls going into the final push to have the support there, you know, beyond our staff and each other. It's just so important. And Italy was a very special spot. There's lots of Canadians in Italy. There's lots of Canadian connections to Italy. So we had a lot of local fans that jumped on our bandwagon too, which was a lot of fun.
Did you have much family with you guys, Roy, at all?
We had no one, I think. This was probably the first time. We were just...
It's funny, the guy. What, is it a guy-girl thing? Because I see parents travel with the girls a lot. The guys, for whatever reason, I don't see as often. I don't know if it's socioeconomic, backgrounds, different.
Might be a little bit of everything. I'm not sure. This summer was obviously the challenges of Cairo were... That's not an easy place to afford to go to and then navigate and... So I don't think we had a parent this summer. I think it was just us. And maybe it helped. Maybe it helped us just kind of come together even more because it was just us. But it's challenging. It's not easy for these kids, for sure. Again, I mean, I know I said that earlier, but in the past, depending on location, we've had a different, you know, kind of turnout as far as parents are concerned. But, yeah, I'm not sure if it's dramatically different on the men and women's side, but maybe it is.
Let's finish with the national team experience with where it ended this summer with your medals. In your case, Roy, I hate to use the hockey analogy, and I realize that we've been building to where you got this summer, so it's not at all similar. But when you look at the USA hockey gold, the miracle, they beat the dreaded Russians in the semifinal.
Yeah.
And then somehow the next day had to get up to beat Finland. But nobody ever remembers that they had to beat Finland. They think that was a gold medal. In your case, you beat the Americans. Like you said, you got on the wrong side of the draw.
Yeah.
You beat the Americans in the semi. How did you get back up the next day after taking down the world power and win again the next day?
Yeah, I mean, I would probably go a day before and say that our greatest win in that tournament was beating France in the quarterfinal. That was a very, very strong French team. That was a team that I don't think people really understand the type of talent that they had. You know, we lost to them in a pre-tournament and came back and beat them in the World Championship. So, you know, we played the U.S. the next day, but we were, you know, 4 points down with under, you know, about 3 minutes left in FIBA Americas when they had an even stronger team that summer because of, you know, Michael Porter Jr. and some of the guys that weren't in,
in Cairo. So I thought, you know, after we beat the U.S., it was just, there was no way we were going to lose the world champ. We knew we were going to win that game from the moment the U.S. game ended. Now, we didn't prepare that way. We prepared the way we did every other game, but all of our guys had a sense of confidence that, you know, there was no stopping us, and it played itself out perfectly.
Do you worry at all about overconfidence like we already in the players'
minds? That's why it's good to lose to Spain. That's why it's good to lose to France in a pre-tournament. That's why losses are, you know, opportunities for growth. And, you know, our guys were just, you know, resilient enough and smart enough and tough enough to know that, you know, it's going to be about us and our effort and our execution. I don't think there was anybody in that locker room, coach or player, that ever thought that we would lose to.
And Carly, your bronze medal game beating Japan. Can you talk a little bit about how exciting that was and the culmination of all the work that went in?
There were so many special things that happened throughout the summer. And one of the first ones was that we were in training camp at Humber when our men were in the medal round. And twice we stopped practice to watch the end of the semi and the end of the final and have our athletes watch that and take it in. And that was such an interesting experience because long before the men had success, we had set a goal that we wanted to medal at the championship. But then watching them win gold, you know, I think did two things to us. It, one, gave us some belief that we could truly achieve what we wanted to achieve, but it also added some pressure. Because now the men had won gold and our athletes had wanted it so badly that, the men did it. Now we want to do it. We want to share that special experience. And some athletes throughout different parts of our summer were maybe carrying the weight of that a little bit. So, you know, that in itself was such a special experience in preparing us for the whole tournament. And, similar to the men, we had a pre-competition tournament where we got beat up pretty good by France and Australia and ultimately beat China in our pre-competition. But France was in our pool and we knew we had to beat them in our pool to avoid the U.S. So similar situation to the men. So just looking back at the tournament, that game was where we truly got a sense of who we could be. And we had really played well and done some spectacular things after that as well. But we ran into a Russian team in our semifinal that absolutely destroyed us, and they were incredible. They made 9 threes in the first half, which is a really, really high number. They had one of the best. They had the best post player in the tournament. So the interesting part about our bronze medal win was we got beat as bad as we got beat all summer, less than 24 hours before we were going into a bronze medal game. And we were playing Japan, who competed with the U.S. up until the last 2 minutes and rolled 12 athletes the whole game. So I was pretty concerned about our ability to rebound from the butt kicking that we took, and Japan's momentum that they were carrying into the bronze medal game. But our athletes were incredibly resilient. Similarly, I don't know that I had the same confidence maybe the athletes had that we were going to beat Japan, but they were just so determined to get it done. And it was just very special to see them wake up the next morning and they were all into everything we were doing in our preparation. And, you could see it 1 through 12, as I mentioned before, those 3 athletes that didn't touch the floor that were, you know, yelling until they couldn't yell anymore and in support and encouragement. That was a pretty special moment for me to see the resilience they showed after losing to the eventual world champion. So we at least have that to carry with our Russian loss in the semi.
Well, both moments are incredible, and everybody in Canada is so proud of the accomplishments and excited about where both programs are headed. The national team, the men's and women's national programs are headed in the right direction. It's fantastic. One topic you brought up there at the end, which is going to allow me to segue into our finishing thing here, is where I'll bring it back to Ryerson here for you guys. You mentioned the pressure that was added almost by the guys winning and you watching and feeling that. How much internally back here at Ryerson now do you feed off each other's success? We were fortunate enough where we are to win a national championship 5 years ago, and the level of the programs around us seem to have risen. And now I feel pressure because last year we were terrible And meanwhile, our men's volleyball team's going to the nationals for the third time in 4 years. Our women's basketball team's gone to the OCA finals 4 years in a row. And I'm going, I can't lag behind here. I feel terrible now. How do you guys feed off each other and the success that each of you have had? And do you feel pressured to almost compete against each other?
I'll take that one to start because Roy was here a couple of years before I was and began developing his program. And you know, I would say really paved the way in showing that it could be done in some ways and how it could be done. And, you know, over the past few years, it's just been really, really enjoyable more than anything to share success. When we get on the bus now and we're celebrating wins together as opposed to the other side of it is a lot of fun. And I think, you know, probably early on for me, I definitely felt some pressure of that and just wanting to be good. But I think it's not about competing against each other for me. It's about, you know, celebrating the success of the men's program and really all of our teams here now. And any of the pressure, I think, comes from myself and just my overall desire to win and strive for excellence. And I think it's inspirational to watch the other teams around us, whether it's our men's basketball program and other teams, have success. I think we're just building that culture of doing it together.
Pressure. You know, that's been pretty well throughout my whole career. I mean, I don't think it's been anything different at Ryerson than it was when I was at Eastern. And every year you were expected to go undefeated. And if you didn't, you had a bad year, forget about winning at all. So it's something that I'm pretty accustomed to, you know, the weight of expectation, the weight of pressure. So it was something that just had to get done when I got here at Ryerson. It wasn't about what anybody else was doing. It was, how are we going to figure this out and how are we going to build a program of excellence? And I think the beautiful thing about watching where the women have gone is, you know, often we're out there, we're exploring ways to get better and we're trying to find, you know, best practices in our field and visiting other coaches. And the beautiful thing now is we can just, you know, open the door and have a conversation about how to get better, because you know, what Carly's been able to do is tremendously inspirational. There's great learning there. So, I think we're getting to a place where we're able to share more, where we're able to explore more. And I think that makes our job even more rewarding. And I think we're starting to see each other, both programs, as a team and not separately, where it's the men's and the women. And I think we're starting to align a little bit more in what we do as a department. So great opportunities, more than any type of competition against each other. Because in the end, we're not playing for the same championship, right? We're supporting each other in our, and our athletes too. I mean, it's about them. I mean, we who doesn't want to see a young woman here at Ryerson win a national championship, or a young man? I mean, we've got quality kids, we've got character kids, and I think we both try to do it the right way, and I think it's all about that. It's just all about celebrating each other's success and maybe learning from each other's grind.
And Roy, what are we expecting out of your guys this year?
I have no idea. Just that they're going to play hard every day, and we'll have a pretty talented group on the floor. I think our league is getting tougher. The change in playoff format makes it much, much more difficult for our best teams to necessarily represent us every year at national championships. I think it's just a reality. So it's going to be an even greater challenge. But we got a great group of guys. We're really deep. I'm excited about the group. And hopefully we can have another special season like we did last year.
Carly, your group, are you ready?
I think we will be. You know, similar to the men's side, our league is getting stronger and deeper every single year. We've got lots of new faces and we'll be dealing with the change and the integration of that. But one of my athletes described our team and the feel right now as fresh, which I think is a great feel to have. They're all similar, going to work their butts off every single possession. And it'll be interesting to see how the season goes all throughout the OUA and Canada for that matter.
Hey, it's Dan here. I'm just going to jump in real quick and tell you about us, Coach Calls Timeout. We're a basketball coaching resource. If you're a coach and you need a few plays or drills or practice plans, check us out at coachcallstimeout.com. We have something that nobody else does. All of our plays and drills are in video format, no still shots, and they can be downloaded directly to your laptop, phone, or tablet. All the videos are small enough files that you can send them to your players to use as a study guide, or you can use them during practices or timeouts. As a podcast listener, we have a special offer for you. Just go to coachcallstimeout.com right after this episode. When you're signing up to become a member, just use the coupon code PODCAST, and you'll receive a free 7-day trial to sample everything we have to offer. Let's get back to the interview and the full court press.
We wrap up every segment with a full court press, just a couple of quick questions for each of you with short answers. So today, though, we've got both of you, so I'll go back and forth as get you to answer each of these, some small ones. Carly, we'll start with you. In order from favorite to least favorite coaching duties, rank the following: recruiting, player development, or game competition.
Least favorite first or last?
First.
Okay. Game comp, player development, recruiting.
Roy?
So this is like favorite to least favorite?
Yes.
Oh, jeez.
Don't give me that.
Player development.
Okay, I was going to say, you go, oh, I like all three. I thought
player, No. Player development, recruiting, and...
game competition.
Managing my expenses.
Okay. Would you rather see a 5-minute highlight video of a player or a full quarter of real game footage, Carly?
Full quarter.
Both, because if I don't like the highlight video, I don't want to watch the quarter.
Good point.
That's true. One thing that you look for in recruiting that kids wouldn't necessarily realize?
Just how they are as a teammate and like response to mistakes or adversity.
Yeah, just I don't think they realize how much background work that maybe I'm doing to find out what their characters are.
Favorite sport outside of basketball?
Playing or watching?
Both.
Ooh. Golf and...
Golf to play?
Yep.
Okay.
Now. And to watch, maybe football or baseball.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really playing any type of organized sport anymore, but probably if I was to make a comeback and be back in the slow pitch world, that's probably
like... we like watching, though.
Watching's boxing. I'm a big boxer.
Boxing? Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, and finally, one word to describe your summer accomplishment.
Proud.
Yeah, surreal.
Well, this is where the host kisses the butt of the people who are kind enough to invite it. But in all sincerity, the roles that you guys have with our national program, they can be polarizing sometimes. People, why did this person get the job? Why doesn't that person get the job? In all honesty, as I travel around, I've never, ever had anyone say anything negative or not in support of each of you in the positions that you're in. And I think that says a lot to the character of you guys. And I think if people listen to this podcast and listen to your previous podcasts, that really comes through. The values that you preach and the intelligence that you speak with, they're admired. So I think the country's in good hands when we have people like yourselves leading our program. So thanks very much for having me here today. And good luck with your seasons this year.
Thanks.
There you have it. Not hard to see why Carly and Roy are so successful. The most important aspect of coaching is communication. If you're not making it a priority, then you need to start right now. Speaking of communication, we have a forum on our website, coachcallstimeout.com, where coaches can go to talk shop, learn from each other, and gain experience without even being in the gym. I recently gave Brian a call to talk about one of the questions on the forum, and it directly relates to being a good communicator. Let's listen in. Okay, so I'm going to read this question from one of our forum users, Carol Sandy. Here, I'll just read it verbatim for you, Bri. I'm getting ready to start the new season and had a rough experience with a couple parents last year. Does anyone know of any ways to keep parents happy or at least avoid constant backseat driving? Any help would be appreciated. Well, what kind of help can you give her?
Coaching parents any different than coaching players? I mean, if you look at it that way, I mean, it's all about communication. So if you're communicating with the parents up front from the beginning of the season, hopefully you have a good pulse on a lot of the situations. And if there are issues, you're going to understand and sniff them out kind of before they get too big, and you're going to deal with them immediately. And if you can communicate that stuff to the parents about the kids, then I think that will help.
But let's get right into it. Like, what do you mean by stuff? What kind of things do you need to communicate beforehand?
Well, what are the expectations for people's kids? And I think, too, it depends a little bit on the age group. I mean, with my college men, to be honest with you, I might have had two parents in 13 years come and talk to me about anything. I think at that age, they start to realize that they're basically, their kids are young men, and they let them deal with issues on their own. So the kids will come to me all the time and express concern about playing time or those types of things. At the younger ages, like with my daughter's young team, when we coached them for 4 years through, you know, grades 4, 5, or 5, 6, 7, 8, you won't necessarily have kids come and confront you about some of the issues that they might be upset about. And quite frankly, at that age, a lot of the unhappiness, if you will, is usually generated from the parents and what expectations they have for their child. So I think if you can confront things early in the year and try and figure out what is the parental expectation for their particular child and what do they believe should happen, then that opens a dialogue up for you as a coach to be able to almost coach the parents and say, okay, well, here's my expectation. Here's what we believe. Here's what we're seeing. Johnny or Sally, maybe if they can progress to this stage, they would be potentially open to getting this type of playing time, this side or the other. But I think it all comes down to, again, communicating and talking and managing the expectations of not only the athlete, but of the parent, and that would help.
So how often do you recommend meeting with parents or talking to the parents about that kind of stuff? Like, are you talking beginning of the year, middle of the year, towards the end of the year kind of thing? Or is it constant? And how do you go about managing that, I guess?
I would think the beginning of the year is necessary, and then after that I think it would be up to you to decide, you know, the pulse of the situation. Maybe you don't have to deal with or communicate too much on those levels the rest of the year. I always take the opportunity too, like if we're having dinner, if we're at a tournament or something like that, usually you're out with the parents and you're having dinner. I almost coach through dinner. Like, you talk about the things that you talk to with the girls, and you talk about, you know, life lessons and this and that that you're trying to teach. And hopefully the more that you can communicate to them the types of things that you're talking to the kids about, that they have a higher comfort level, and the fact that their child is being coached in a way that they believe is beneficial. I mean, this whole subject, I personally haven't read a better article or better suggestions on how to deal with it than I believe the article that you posted on the forum directly answering this question. And that article is fantastic. What that coach has done with his girls team in managing, it says managing the parents, but it's really you're coaching the parents. What he's done there and the fact that, I mean, read the article. He's got three questions he asks each parent at the beginning of the year that they have to write answers down. And, you know, you get those sort of things in writing. It's almost like a contract. And then the parents are always mindful of that. And you're always mindful of it when you're having discussions. So that article is fantastic. So I'd recommend highly that people go to the forum, look at the subject, and actually click on that article and read it, because it's very, very good. It's not long. It's very, very good, though.
Yeah, so it's in the communication portion of the forum. And the article is from Breakthrough Basketball, and it's titled "How I Stop Dealing with Parents," dealing in quotations. Yeah, it's fantastic. I also have never seen anything that is that good.
It made you think about the way, I mean, it said dealing, like you said, in quotes with parents, but the reality is his main focus is why am I dealing with it? That's a negative connotation. We should be coaching parents and working together with them to try and get the best for their kids. So it's really good. I'd highly recommend people reading it.
If you enjoyed what you heard, we'd appreciate if you could rate us on Apple Podcast or tell someone you know about the show. Everything we talked about today can be found in our show notes at coachcallstimeout.com/29. We'll be back again in 2 weeks with another episode. See you soon.